The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, we'll be looking through the 1926 census returns.
The census is piecing together the jigsaw for a lot of people in many different ways.
I was completely fascinated when I found Dan Bryan's entry. A remarkable man as well. He was in McKee Barracks that night.
Our panel of guests have been delving into some of the individual stories that bring these census records to life.
And he is, as I expected to find him, in Dublin. And he registers himself as an atheist.
And coming up a little later, I'll be joined by broadcaster Ian Dale to talk about political leadership and his series of publications on the lives of leaders across different countries and systems of government. But we begin this evening with the 1926 census. It's been a couple of weeks now since the full returns from Census Night in the Irish Free State have been released online by the National Archives. I'm joined in studio by four historians who've been searching through it, looking at their own family histories and examining the entries of some of the figures they're interested in from their own research. Historian Liz Gillis is the host of the new six-part RTE podcast, Come to Your Census. Great title, which is available now. And that dives into some of the key themes that emerge from the census. And the podcast is a companion to the TV series of the same name going out on RTE One Television, starting this evening at 6:30. Also here with me is Mary McAuliffe, Director of Gender Studies at UCD, Cormac Moore, who's been looking at the Protestant population of Ireland's border counties, and Mark McMenamin, who, among other things, has been looking at his own family history in Donegal. You're all very welcome indeed.
Thank you. Thanks, mate.
Liz, start with you. And you started with your own home place, the Liberties in Dublin. What kind of interesting material did you turn up?
Well, I discovered that my family were on the street that I grew up in 10 years before I thought they were actually there. So had a nose, and I found that there's actually a lot of forced families, residents that were working in Jacobs, and they were there in 26 and actually right through. Some of them, including my own family, are still there in 2026. But then looking at the makeup of the workers, because we would have known those houses as Jacobs houses and Guinness houses, because they are provided for by the employers. So I have found that in the returns that there are Guinness workers, there's Dublin Corporation workers, then there's obviously Jacobs Biscuit Factory. But also I have found that there were a number of young single women living in the houses. So these were like, you know, two up, two down, nice big back garden. But also I went nosing around the streets, around the area, and a neighbour of mine, I found in one of the streets that there was a young boy, 2-year-old boy, named Sylvester Heaney. And I grew up with the Heaneys, and I immediately got on to my mate and I was like, is that your Uncle Sil? Who I would have known in the 80s. Now, what was important about the name was Sylvester Heaney is one of the Leaks of Clive who was executed in January 1923 in the Civil War. And she's like, I've been trying to find them. And it was her family. So Sil, who I knew, he was born a year after his relative was executed in the Civil War, and he's named after him.
Right.
And you're finding those, like you're finding young boys that are named after people who were killed or died in the Civil War. So there's loads of different stories that are emerging from just even one record. It's brilliant.
And I mean, one of the things the census, the two previous ones, 1901, 1911, is that they can solve mysteries, historical mysteries, providing bits of information that, you know, you have been looking for, or in some cases you didn't even know you were looking for, but you find them anyway. Thomas Cullen. Why were you so interested in the entry for Thomas Cullen?
Yeah, I've been trying to track him for a couple of years because, again, a friend of mine, their family moved into a house a couple of years back in the area, and they were presented with like an old sort of firearm from the period of the War of Independence and stuff. And they were asking me like if I knew anything about it, could tell them anything about it, and went looking, and I discovered that there was a Tom Cullen that was the armourer for the 4th Battalion, but I had his address like in the 30s, but I wanted to see if he was in this area in the 1920s. And when the 1926 census was revealed, there he was. So it seems that from his own witness statement, he was just putting like firearms in like houses all along the street, like stashing them everywhere. So obviously all of them weren't collected. But it is, the census is piecing together the jigsaw for a lot of people in many different ways. And now I have him there. So it's great. It cements the suspicions that I had of him.
Mary, your own family. Let's talk about your own view. Yes. Immediate family, mm-hmm. first of all. What did you find when you, if you, anything unusual, anything really particularly interesting, or just what you expected?
Well, in many ways, it's just what I expected. They're all in North Kerry. So we're North Kerry for way back on all sides. McAuliffe, O'Connor, Kennelly, Boland, Ahern. I did find that my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, Bridget or Bridie Ahern, is a teenager and she's away in boarding school in the Daughters of Charity in Dunmanway. Her family are in Ballyline, just outside Ballylongford in North Kerry. I cannot find my paternal grandmother, who was in Cumann na mBan and was one of the women gun running and also involved in the young men who were shot in Gurta Glanna. She would have helped bury them. She is not in the house in 1926. I cannot find her anywhere. My grandfather, Timothy Kennelly, I had been doing a bit of research on him prior to the 1926 coming out, because we'd always heard he was in America for that decade. And he comes back in 1932, apparently to say goodbye. He's be, you know, the final goodbye. He was going to become an American citizen, spent his life there. He meets Bridie, my grandmother. They fall in love and he gets married and never goes back to America.
Life is what happens when you're making other choices.
But actually, what I did discover with him is in the 1920 census in London. He had gone to London in 1920 and he's working there. The story is he was targeted by the Black and Tans and he had to be gotten out of the country for his own safety. So he's obviously back in Ireland in 26 and he is in America in 1930. So he is doing a lot of travelling in that decade and then he settles in Ballylongford in North Kerry in 1932. But other than that, they're all where I expected them to be. They're all farmers. They're all around the North Kerry, Listowel, Dwoe, Ballylongford area. And that's where I expected to find them.
And you've got a celebrity in the extended family, the dramatist, the playwright George Fitzmaurice.
Yes,
what did you find out about him?
Interestingly, I was just looking. I thought, oh, I better look. I knew George was up in Dublin at that stage because he's working in the civil service. And also some of his plays were put on in the Abbey Theatre by Yeats at that stage. Magic Glasses, all of that sort of thing. He would have been similar to Singh in his writing. And he is, as I expected to find him, in Dublin. And he registers himself as an atheist. Everybody else
census.
Was Catholic in the census. So an atheist from Dwoe in North Kerry was not a very usual thing to find in the census.
You think so if he'd still been in North Kerry that he would have classified himself as an atheist?
Well, his two sisters are still there, Miss Georgina, and I can't remember what the second woman is, and they're still farming the old family homestead, and they register as Catholic, even though they actually were, their father was a vicar. He was a Church of Ireland vicar, but of course the girls were brought up, he married a Catholic woman, and that's how we're related to them. O'Connor, and the girls were brought up Catholic and the boys Protestant. So George goes from Church of Ireland to atheist
okay.
in his lifetime.
That's the family stuff. Now, obviously, also you have areas of research that you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You're hugely involved over the years with the commemoration of Cumann na mBan women. What emerges when you start looking for individual prominent Cumann na mBan members?
Well, I started with the prominent ones to just find them and see what they were saying and what I discovered, which is frustrating sometimes because then you have to Google what their Irish name is that they're signing the census in Irish. So Margaret Skinnader is Moraidne Skinnadora, living with Nora Ní Chaoimh, Nora O'Keefe, her partner for a long time. They're living in Waverley Avenue in Fairview. They do move the following year to Seaview Terrace in Clontarf, where they will spend the rest of their lives. So they're there with Margaret's brother, Thomas. At this stage, the two women, Margaret, who became a teacher and was a mathematical teacher, that's why they got her to draw the barracks before 1916, because she was very good at figures. doesn't get a job as a teacher till 1928. So she's working as a bookkeeper with the Workers' Union out of Liberty Hall. And Nora is a stenographer with the Workers' Union. And it's really interesting to see what they're working at. Most of the women you come across are home duties, or down the country, if they're working on their family farm, they're assisting on the farm with farm duties.
And Margaret Skinner at this stage has she already been denied the pension that she was denied,
even though she
had far more active part of the 1916 rising than most of the men.
She's been to America on the Republican Women's Tour, which is where she meets Nora and they come back together. She has applied for the pension and been denied the pension at this stage. So they're bringing in income into the household, yeah.
And you were also looking at my personal hero from the 1916 rising, that's Elizabeth O'Farrell.
Yes, herself and Julia Grennan, only that I knew where they were living. I don't think I would have found them because they both sign it in Irish and Elizabeth is Sibale in it and Julia Sheila, S-I-G-H-L-E, the old-fashioned way of spelling Sheila. But they're there in Mount Street, the two of them sharing the house together, nobody else in the house with them. So again, this proves they had been living together since before 1916. They will continue to live in that house until Elizabeth dies of a heart attack when they're both walking on Bray Beach. And Julia continues living there until she dies in the early 1970s. So it's really interesting to find them there and a bit poignant as well to see them together. Mm. I had thought when I couldn't find them, when I put in Elizabeth's name and then Julia's name, that maybe because they continue to reject the legitimacy of the state, perhaps they didn't fill in the census. But actually they did, but they did it in Irish.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, one woman who comes across in the census as being extremely glad to be single, you tracked her down. Who was that?
Is it Alice Marr, who was said, you know, where they put in, are you single or not? And she goes, single, thank God. And good woman, yes. A woman after my own heart in some ways.
Mark, let's talk about a couple of people whose lives that you've researched, two particularly prominent people from the what we call the emergency, the otherwise known as the Second World War. Somebody written about in your book, Codebreaker, Richard Hayes, fascinating character, director of the National Library, but a cryptographer supreme. Where was he on census night in 1926?
So Richard Hayes was actually, he was in Finglas, in Springmount in Finglas, age 23. He was there with his mother, Katie. She was aged 54. Living with Mammy. They'd moved from Abbeyfield in County Limerick. So that's where Richard Hayes was born. He was born in what became the Bank of Ireland, and unfortunately is not the Bank of Ireland anymore, but the building is still there. We were lucky enough to get a plaque put up on it a couple of years ago to commemorate that Richard was actually born there. He had moved to Finglas, and it says actually on his entry that he's an assistant librarian, so he's begun working at the National Library. He would later go on to become the assistant director and eventually the director then during the Second World War. You know, he was recruited then obviously by military intelligence and, you know, went on to have great skill at cryptography, amongst other things. He lists himself here as being able to speak English and Irish, obviously, but there are languages, but he spoke quite a few, you know, Arabic, German, which would have come in handy later on in life for him.
But there wasn't enough room in the census for him to
there
put
wasn't
them all
enough
in.
Room in the census for him for Richard Hayes, I don't think, no.
Another important character in the story of Ireland during the emergency, and again comes into your books, The Codebreaker and Ireland's Secret War, Dan Bryan, who was director of military intelligence. He recruited Hayes, didn't he?
He recruited Hayes into military intelligence. Now, I was completely fascinated when I found Dan Bryan's entry. A remarkable man as well. He was in McKee Barracks that night, and he was with various other people. You know, it gives his rank. He was actually at the rank of commandant at that stage, at the age of 26, actually. In his barracks, he had a guy called Timothy Killeen. Niall Harrington was another fellow that was there as well. And they're all listed in the various barracks along. You are basically looking at military intelligence there. Mm. All the guys that would have been there, if they're in McKee Barracks, that is. Now, and I'd always been fascinated with wondering who were the actual people that were involved in G2 in military intelligence. And this is the names of a lot of the people. So you're looking at the
names. So they're basically hanging out together.
Yeah.
You know, what, 13, 14 years before they really, really assert themselves.
Before they really assert themselves. So it's the nascent intelligence service, you know, there at that stage. And when I looked actually, you know, further along in one of the other barracks, I was able to find Colonel Eamon de Butler, who would actually go on to be a codebreaker with Richard Hayes and an interrogator of some of the German spies in Custine Barracks and other places. Now, de Butler is 23 and he fills out his form Oscaliga. But again, another incredible man as well. So they were all in McKee Barracks that night.
Cormac, you've talked to us a lot about the Boundary Commission over the years and the different border communities that were in play as the exact delineation of the border was being debated. Now you've actually got a chance now to look at specific townlands yeah. along the border. Talk to us, one fascinating one, Pettigo, on the Donegal-Fermanagh border. I mean, it's basically a town that's split in two. What does this 26th census tell us about the decline in the number of Protestants in the Irish Free State, 4 years old at that stage?
Yeah, we probably should start with saying that we don't know what happens across the border because,
yeah. Unfortunately, yeah, this is fascinating.
That census, which took place the same day, even though it's a different jurisdiction, has disappeared or destroyed, presumably in the Second World War, but which is a great shame because, you know, we wonder where do these Protestants go from the Free State afterwards. So we're none the wiser as to those who went.
So if we had that census from 1926 in Northern Ireland, we could check it against the 1911
absolutely,
census.
Absolutely, yeah. Which would be an invaluable source.
Okay.
But Pettigo, I looked at Pettigo, so in the main street of Pettigo, which in 1911 there were 138 people in the main street overall, and in 1926 there were 111, so there was a decline. But it was a decrease in the Protestant decline. So 64 Church of Ireland members in 1911, that went down to 40 in 1926. There were 7 Presbyterians in 1911, only 2 left in 26. And there were 4 Methodists and there were 0 in 1926. So there was a very sharp decline of, we can presume that a lot of them did go over the border to the Fermanagh side.
Yeah.
You
can assume that they're only, a few metres away or a few hundred metres away from where they would have been in 1911.
Potentially.
We don't know and we're never going to know.
Yeah. But Drum's a very interesting one because Drum's in Monaghan, of course, that's where former Minister Heather Humphreys is from. And that town went down from 95 to 77. But the Protestant population didn't go down that much at all. So there was 22 Church of Ireland members in 1911, there were 20 in 1926. A sharper decline in Presbyterians, there were 47 in 1911 and 38 in 1926. And there actually was an increase in Methodists. There was 1 in 1911 and 2 in 1926. But it does, and I know Andy Bielenberg has done a lot of work on this, that if there's a kind of a heavy concentration of Protestants in areas in the Free State, the decline isn't that sharp. It isn't usually a third because there's safety in numbers, for want of a better term. Whereas if they're more remote or they're more isolated, there tends to be a much sharper decline.
Okay. Like
my home townland of Coolmanher in Emo in Laois had actually increased the population, overall population, but that was mainly Catholics. It went from 76 Catholics to 90 in 1926. But the Church of Ireland population, it's actually a lovely church there that James Gandon designed. And there still is quite a large Church of Ireland community there. But that declined from 36 to 24 in that period. So that would be a remote area. There wouldn't be a lot of other kind of Church of Ireland or Protestant kind of havens around there. So that was more than 33%.
Did you get any sense of what was happening? I mean, we talked about Donegal, Monaghan. Any sense of what was happening in Cavan? I mean, a place like Black Lion, for example, which would be on the Cavan-Fermanagh border.
Well, I actually looked at, I'm still going through everything, of course, the Saunderson estate.
Yes.
Very, very famously, yes. Somerset Saunderson said, "Now I have no country." When
the Saundersons had been leaders, essentially, of the Unionist Party in the House of Commons.
Before 1900s, So the Saundersons in Cavan went down from 17 in 1911 to 12 in 1926. Now, I couldn't find Somerset Saunderson in either census. Perhaps it wasn't there, or maybe I just haven't looked correctly, but it just shows there was a good decline of Saundersons, at the very least, from Cavan, that they no longer had a country they felt that it could be a part of.
Mark, the census shows, obviously, Protestants who stayed, and some of those were your ancestors. What's your Protestant background?
Yeah, well, I found it interesting just listening to the conversation, and you were saying about Mary was saying about her relatives that objected to the state. Well, mine also objected, but probably in a much different way to yours. My great grandfather he signed the Ulster Solemn League and Covenant, as did my great grandmother in Ballantra, Orange Hall. I come from, I suppose it's not a term thankfully that's used anymore, but what you would have called a mixed marriage back in the day. So I have, relatives Catholic on my father's side and Protestant then on my mother's side. My great-grandfather would have been someone who probably would have objected to the state. I don't believe he was involved in the UVF or he was in the militia or anything like that. But he was someone who, you hear anecdotally through the family that he was a great admirer of Carson, and he stayed. they stayed in the area, they stayed in Ballyshannon. They had a farm there. Our people would, I suppose, originally have come from Aberdeen during the plantation of Ulster, you know, initially to Derry and then on down to South Donegal. Interestingly enough, the townland where they lived and where, you know, they originally come from, there are two parts of it. It's called Ballymagorty, which is near Ballintra and on the way to, between Ballyshannon and Donegal town. And there are two different names and two different areas within Ballymagorty. There's Ballymagorty Irish and Ballymagorty Scotch, you know, and he would have come from the Scotch area, of course. So he would have been someone, quite interestingly, that didn't leave, didn't go across the border and would have stayed. I found that very interesting to, and to see that he was there. Another thing that I found quite interesting, I suppose, and something I think maybe Cormac might be able to maybe tell us a little bit more about, because I'm curious about it myself, it was that some of my relations on the Protestant side of my family deemed themselves Church of Ireland. Mm. And then a lot of them were Episcopalian, which I'd never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a phrase that is common in USA. I mean, they are Episcopalian.
Well, maybe the Church of England or Church of Scotland. Well, they're Episcopalian as well.
Yeah, I was thinking, what I was trying to put my finger on, I suppose, was that in that particular part of South Donegal, and you're looking at Donegal Town, all down that direction, Ballintra in particular, and you have to remember as well that Rosnaula, you know, to this day, is still the only Orange Parade in the South. So there is a huge community there still to this day. A lot of, there were branches of Cooneyites, you know.
Cooneyites?
Yeah, so people that would have kind of, not dissimilar, I suppose, to Mennonites and Amish, that they worshipped at home. They didn't actually attend church. They had lay preachers, you know, that visited houses. And they,
sir, do you have any idea who Cooney was? Or what
well, I did a bit of research into him, and he developed this branch where they broke away from the mainstream church, you know. So, yeah, very interesting. So I wonder, like, were people designating themselves as Episcopalian as a general term for Protestants in the area? You know, and they might have been Cooneyites, they might have been whatever else, you know. So it's interesting.
I don't know if Presbyterians, though, would have ever. So it has to be someone Church of Ireland, England, Scotland that would have maybe.
They would, Presbyterians would never describe themselves as Episcopalians. No way.
It's just the first time I'd ever seen that, you know.
Yeah. Oh, no, Cooneyites, never. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating. Cormac, stay with the border, because, I mean, obviously we are used to just wandering backwards and forwards across the border nowadays, and you wouldn't know where you are, et cetera, et cetera. That was not the case in 1926. I mean, the border, which was. It was a customs barrier, let's remind ourselves, created by the Irish Free State, caused huge problems, didn't it?
Oh yeah, and I think we talk about Petticoat, you know, there was the River Termon was the dividing line, but if you wanted to cross from one side to the other, you had to go through customs posts on both sides. So if you were driving, you know, you had to first of all check in with customs on the Free State side, then you cross the border and you have to check in with customs on the northern side. And that went on pretty much from 1923 right up until the 90s.
And was it Petticoat? Was the railway station?
The railway stations there as well. If you were going to Lough Derg, for example, on the pilgrimage, people generally get off at the Petticoat train station.
And was that in the Free State or was it in...
Well, the actual train station was in the Free State. Mm. But there was a lot of other problems if you were obviously living in the north and going to the train station to go from A to B. You had to, first of all, go by customs to get to the train station and then go on to your destination. So it was a just for people living on the border areas in particular, it was completely...
Yeah. I mean, anecdotally, because I think some of your relatives are from East Donegal.
Yeah, from the Finn Valley area, you know. It's just interesting listening to the train, you know. It's still a point of contention in Donegal. No train since 1951, you know. We often lament that up in the northwest.
You ever seen a map of the train map of Ireland, railway map, and... In 1920s, like a full artery of trains everywhere. Now look at it, the northwest.
It's a blank spot. Actually, my wife and I, we were in Anglesey in Wales there only last year, you know, and they had the same narrow gauge railway system there, and we took a train journey on one of those old trains from Festiniog out to the coast, and it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever actually done. And you know, I remember saying to my wife, "Imagine the tourism potential in Donegal if we had still, you know, or even just, you know, I was discussing with Mary earlier if there was a greenway even there still, you know." But so my actual grandfather would have worked for the Donegal Railway Company, and the, you know, there was some of my family members worked there, and people in the local area. It was still a big employer for a lot of people, you know, back then.
Mary, some pretty niche research that you have done. This is looking at the 1926 census, looking for women whose hair was cropped during the War of Independence or the Civil War. It's pretty niche.
Yes. And I found a few of them. I have a database of nearly 300 women who were hair cropped over about an 18-month period, few in the Civil War, but mostly from about January 1919 to the end of 1921, then some when the violence breaks out in the border area in 1922. But I looked, two of them I found the other day. One of them was in Lixnaw in County Kerry. Her name was Bridget Grady. She was haircropped by the Black and Tans in reprisal for a haircropping of one of their women, so to speak, in September 1920. They'd also come looking for her brother Stephen, who was in the local active service unit and in the Flying Column in North Kerry. And I found them both in the same house. Bridget at this stage is 30. Now, she does get married subsequently to the brother of one of the other girls hair cropped during that. It was a mass attack on Lixnaw. They burnt the creamery, they burnt several houses in the village, and they hair cropped about five girls that night. And they chased Stephen, but they didn't get him. But she's on the farm assisting Stephen. So it's interesting to see that their lives have gone back to that sort of sense of normality outwardly. This is what the census is showing us. But I would imagine, you know, the trauma effect of what had happened, both of them, Bridget and Stephen, would still be there. But they are there living at home. And then another woman who was haircropped by Republicans for company keeping was a Bridget Keegan. And she was in Tuam, near Tuam, a townland outside of Tuam. And there she is still with her parents assisting her father on the farm. So it's interesting, these two women who were one haircropped by the Black and Tans, one by Republicans for company keeping, are both now experiencing the same sort of life, assisting their relatives on small farms in a very country area in their counties, one in Galway and one in Kerry. And Bridie Keegan's sister, whose name is not mentioned, but she's in the census as Mrs. Cornwell, obviously just home, had immigrated to England and was a nurse. So it was Mrs. Cornwell, nurse, is how she's registered. So they're very proud of that. In Lewisham Hospital, which I thought was very interesting. You know, you see these women are also immigrating to get work. And she and her daughter are obviously home on a visit. But they don't give her first name. But I imagine she's the sister who tried to prevent the masked men from hair cropping her sister the night the attack came as well.
OK, Liz, again, to show the extent to which you can undertake pretty niche research with the 1926 census, you've been looking at the IRA in Clondalkin in County Dublin.
Yeah, so I found a list on Military Archives, the membership rolls, and it was just one page, and it was a list of names of lads who were attached to F Company 4th Battalion of Dublin Brigade of the IRA, but the 4th Battalion and F Company were like around Inchicore and so on, but these lads were specifically from Clondalkin, and I just started looking at them, and I found them in 1901, found them in 1911, and then they're there in 1926. You have a mix of fellas who would have went pro-treaty and anti-treaty, but then it's great like to go back to that list, have their addresses in the 1920s. I've actually been talking to some of their relatives because they're generational. They're from there, born and bred there, and their families continue to have a connection with Clondalkin. So that has been absolutely brilliant. And then just for one of the other families that I'm so connected with, that I've done so much research on, is the Hales family in West Cork. I found them. And that family, what they went through, Tom and Sean, symbolising the split in the Civil War.
Well, just explain a little bit about the history of the Hales family during this period, because Sean Hales, I think, would be fairly familiar.
Yeah, so Sean Hales was pro-treaty and would have been very close to Collins, as was Tom. But Tom took the anti-treaty side while Sean took the pro-treaty side. And Tom oversaw the ambush in which Collins was killed in August 1922. Sean was one of the last people to talk to Collins before he sets off to Bayonne na Blaw. But then Sean is assassinated, or was assassinated, in Dublin in December 1922.
And that triggers a huge animosity on the part of the government, and that
yes,
essentially triggers a lot of the executions.
Yeah, while you had executions starting in November 1922, this is the Mountjoy Four are executed as a pure reprisal for the assassination of Sean Hales, who was a TD as well as a Brigadier General in the Free State Army. But Sean was the eldest. So if you look at the 1911 census, like, Sean would have inherited the family farm. But compared in 1911 to 1926, Sean had died. He'd been assassinated. Their father had died because he had suffered from ill health. The family had gone through so much in those 15 years between the two census. And Tom is the youngest son, but now Tom is running the farm. Like, the farm had been, the house had been destroyed by the military in the War of Independence, and her sister Madge was running it. So, like, if we look at the end of the War of Independence into the Civil War, Tom, Robert, William, three brothers, they're on the run. They eventually all end up in prison. Sean's assassinated. Madge is keeping it all together. And then they're all there in 1926. Tom's running the farm. They're helping run the farm. In a couple of years, they'd be married. They'd be starting their own families. But the Hales family are still there today. But it could have been so different. The 1926 census would have been so different if Sean had lived. It wouldn't be that Tom was running the farm, but he takes over that role. So that was lovely. It just, again, just puts a little, another element to their story.
And the census shows people's occupation, but it also prompted people to put down their previous place of work. And that has enabled you to do something very interesting. That's to look at who were ex-National Army soldiers.
Yes, you're seeing that because even though, like, people are putting down out of work because they had to stipulate if they were out of work, but then a lot of them, you just go across and you see Free State Army, National Army. And there's going to be an awful lot of them because during the Civil War, shortly after the Battle for Dublin, the Free State Army increased by huge, huge numbers. Thousands, nearly 50,000 that it exploded to. But in peacetime, there was no way the army could stay that size. So,
I mean, you'd had already had 1924 was the demobilisation, which caused problems of its own, obviously.
So you're seeing that. So you're going to be able to trace, like, although there was a 1922 census done for the military, you'll actually be able to trace who was in the army in those intervening years between 22 and 26. And now what are they doing? A lot of them are at work. A lot of them are in different occupations. But with one in particular, he was out of work for a couple of months. And then you go across and he was National Army, had been a member of the National Army. So that's going to be a great resource to add to the information we already have.
That actually just reminds me, because I live in Stonybatter, so I've been looking around where I live now as well. And in my own house in Stonybatter, there was a gas fitter worked in the Inchicore Ironworks. But I looked at a lot of the other people living around Oxmantown Road, up onto Manor Street. A lot of them are ex-RIC or ex-British soldiers, because, of course, the Royal Barracks was nearby, now Collins Barracks. And so they're living around that area as well. So it's interesting to see a lot of them stay in the country. Many of them may have retired before the War of Independence, so they didn't experience that. But they don't leave the country. You know, they obviously feel safe enough to stay in Dublin particularly, and perhaps like with the Protestant populations, there's enough of them that there are communities of ex-military and ex-RIC.
I presume, before we conclude, you would all encourage people to go on the website and to check out.
Well, yeah, I think particularly for me, my background, I'm a secondary school teacher and I teach in St. David's in Greystones. And I think it's a fantastic resource for any student for doing, you know, their CBA as a junior cycle, for their RSRs, for leaving cert. But particularly we're looking forward now towards doing additional assessment components for the new leaving cert, and looking forward to that, where research is going to be a much bigger element. It's going to be a fantastic resource for students going forward.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. My thanks to our guests, Liz Gillis, Mary McAuliffe, Cormac Moore and Mark McMenamin, for sharing some of their own findings from the 1926 census. If you haven't already, get on to nationalarchives.ie. Fantastic resources, everybody's been saying. It's all free. Well, I mean, you were paying for it as taxpayers, but it's well worth it. And the product of a huge amount of digitization work by the National Archives, amazing work by the National Archives. After the break, I'll be joined by broadcaster Ian Dale, author of several books about historical leaders. Stay with us. Welcome back. Now we're going to talk about political leadership with someone who spent a lot of time looking at the lives of leaders across different countries and systems of government. I'm joined by broadcaster Ian Dale. Through the books he's edited and various podcasts, he's explored the lives of prime ministers, American presidents, British monarchs, dictators from around the world, and most recently, Taoiseach. His most recent book, The Taoiseach, A Century of Political Leadership, looks at the 16 men, and they are all men, who have served in that role since the foundation of the state. You're very welcome to the History Show, Ian.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with prime ministers. That's where you started this journey, this multi-volume project on leadership. Sir Robert Walpole is considered to be the first British prime minister. Why is he, does he have that signal honour?
Well, before 1721, so it's like 300 years ago, the prime minister of the day was always referred to as the first Lord of the Treasury because they were effectively finance minister, chancellor too. But he was prime minister for 21 years and he became so dominant in the whole system of government that he was referred to by many people as prime minister. He didn't like it because he regarded it really as a bit of an insult. And the term started to be used a bit more after that. The first time it's mentioned in legislation, believe it or not, was 1906. And the prime minister nowadays is still referred to as the first Lord of the Treasury, but that title has really fallen into abeyance.
And the prime minister of Britain didn't always hold the same type of power that they do today. How did the role evolve into the modern prime ministerial role where everything seems to be focused on and centred on Downing Street?
Yeah, and latterly, I would say prime ministers, since probably John Major, Tony Blair, power has been centred on Downing Street. Every government decision has to be run through the centre, and I think that's the same with the office of the Taoiseach, because it's developed in a way that mirrors the role of the prime minister to some degree. Back in the 18th, 19th centuries, the key relationship for a prime minister was with the monarch of the day. And particularly in the 18th century, you had to keep the monarch happy because they had the power to dismiss you. Now you have to keep voters happy, which is probably just as difficult.
But there would have been some prime ministers who would have had fairly toxic relationships with the monarch. I mean, I'm thinking of Gladstone and Queen Victoria. She loathed him.
Yeah, because there was always the contrast with Disraeli, who made every effort to charm her, and he was very successful at it. Whereas Gladstone was much more formal. He was a very austere character. Look, most relationships in politics are built on personal relationships. If two world leaders get on, then their countries are going to get on. If they don't get on, then there's trouble ahead. We've got so many examples of that. It's the same in domestic politics. It's the same in the relationship between the monarch and the prime minister. I mean, Queen Elizabeth had her favourite. She got on very well with Harold Wilson, didn't get on so well with Boris Johnson.
Do British prime ministers tend to be that much more powerful because coalition governments are almost unknown in the UK, or are British political parties effectively coalitions anyway?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's a very good point because I think most political parties have a broad spread of opinion within them, and it's the same in any country. I mean, you look at the political outlook of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I mean, they're actually not that different, but within the parties, there are strands of opinion. It's the same with the Conservative and Labour parties in Britain. And you look at the way politics is developing in Britain now, where Reform UK effectively has emerged out of the Conservative Party. You've got the new left-wing Your Party, and to an extent, the Green Party, where they've managed to take people out of the Labour Party. So there's always a flux in politics. And the power of the centre is probably more than it's ever been. But a prime minister only rules because they have the support of their own parties. We had an example recently where Keir Starmer wanted to give the Americans permission to use our air bases to launch raids on Iran, but he was prevented from doing so by several members of his cabinet because he couldn't get them on board. So there are limits to prime ministerial power.
We'd assume that Margaret Thatcher was one of the most assertive prime ministers, but was that actually the case, or did she rely more on consensus building rather than being authoritarian?
She didn't like the word consensus. She preferred the word conviction. And she led from the front. She chaired the cabinet, but she gave her views before she asked for the views of all of her cabinet. John Major did the opposite. He would go around the table and then sum up, which is a conventional chairing mode. The modern perception of Margaret Thatcher is that she was quite dictatorial, but actually the reverse is true. She actually liked a good argument within cabinet. She liked to prevail, who doesn't? But she did allow her cabinet ministers to do their job. She didn't monitor every single decision that they made in the way that modern day prime ministers do. If you're Secretary of State for Health, she lets let the Secretary of State for Health get on with running the health service. Whereas now, we're streeting our current Secretary of State for Health. Everything has to be referred to officials in number 10 before we can go ahead and do them.
So with Thatcher, it wasn't quite like the spitting image.
I mean, look, every politician has a caricature, and there's always some element of truth in the caricature, but the caricature is only a sort of percentage true. And yes, she was very strident. Yes, towards the end of her time in office, she became very regal, but it was all a bit of an exaggeration.
Now, you've covered US presidents, UK prime ministers, dictators, monarchs. Why the Irish Taoiseach? I mean, pretty far down the international political food chain, you know. Why not prime ministers of Luxembourg, for example?
You do yourself down. No, the reason was that I was watching a series on Netflix called Rebellion, all about the Easter Rising. It was done by RTE. And I assumed, in my naivety, that it would probably be fairly anti-British in tone. It was a drama. It wasn't at all. It was very fair. And I thought to myself, why do I know so little about Irish politics or Irish history? So I began to read up, sort of watch other documentaries, and I became sort of fascinated with Irish politics. So that was really the reason I put this book together. And my next book is going to be on this day in Ireland. So it's going to be sort of one page per event on a particular day in Irish history. So the obsession is continuing.
Oh, very good. Now, obviously, you're aware of the fact that through one of our great political experts, political professors, political analysts, Brian Farrell, we have this notion of the Taoiseach as chairman or chief. And I think you've already said that in Ireland, that there's a similar pattern to the pattern, obviously going back much further in the UK, but there is a similar pattern to the way that the prime ministership has developed.
Yes, I think you look at the number of people employed by the office of the Taoiseach now compared to what it was in the 1950s or 60s, and it's grown exponentially, just as the number of people who work in number 10 Downing Street has grown. But I think the basics are still very similar. You are still chairman of the cabinet. Obviously, in Ireland, you have almost permanent coalition politics. So I think that's the main difference between your system and our system, obviously as a result of your electoral system. And when you've got sometimes 3-4 parties that you have to keep happy, it can lead to sort of more unstable government. And we see that in Israel, for example, where Netanyahu has to form a coalition maybe of 5, 6, 7 parties, some of them very extreme. And that's always been the case. And yet there's no real movement for a change in the electoral system there, which I always find weird. And I don't think there is in Ireland as well.
Now, you said that leaders reflect their times and that we get the leaders we deserve. Does that imply that in Ireland, for example, character is less important than circumstance?
I think in Ireland and the UK, what you tend to do is if you have a charismatic prime minister or Taoiseach, they're then usually followed by a fairly dull one. And then you have another charismatic one, and then you have another dull one. If you look back to, certainly in Britain since 1945, that has tended to be the case. I mean, it hasn't quite been right recently, because when Boris Johnson was prime minister, I always thought, well, Keir Starmer is going to be the next prime minister, so he will keep that tradition going. But then, of course, we had Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak in the interim. I mean, each prime minister has a unique style, and some of them are more appealing to the electorate than others. I mean, I would say, for example, I mean, Leo Varadkar, I think, had an easier, more populist style than Micheál Martin does. I mean, Micheál Martin, I think, in some ways, is very like Keir Starmer. Somebody who sort of looks very competent, is calm, is collected, is never going to set the world on fire, but I think generally commands quite a bit of respect, even from his opponents.
As an outsider coming in and learning about Irish history, what do you make of our Civil War divide?
In a way, it's still odd that it still exists, I suppose. I mean, it is obviously a century, well, more than a century ago now. And I think the fact that the two parties are still divided in that way is slightly odd. I mean, to be influenced by an event that was 100 years ago. But when I've been doing the research for the current book, so much of Irish politics, Irish society nowadays is dominated by the results from that period. And I think probably for a Brit, it may be quite difficult to understand, but everything seems to have emanated from that. You had the Progressive Democrats formed in the 1990s, but they didn't last very long. They seemed to me to be a much more traditional, small state, socially liberal party, which I would have thought would resonate more with the times. And you look at the way that Irish society has developed over the last 30 years with the different referendums, the different changes in social legislation, you would have thought a party like that would have actually been quite successful, but obviously it didn't last that long.
Which then of our Taoiseach stands out for you as the most consequential? I'm going to ask you to remove Eamon de Valera from your thinking because, you know, he is, I suppose, essentially the most consequential of all. But forgetting about de Valera, which of the other 15 do you think has been the most consequential?
I would say possibly Sean Lamass. Because although he wasn't Taoiseach for that long, I think was it 6-7 years, I think he laid down the foundations of what was to follow. I think he was quite, although in some ways quite an austere character, quite an inspirational character for many. And I think he saw which way Ireland should go. I mean, the fact that joining the European Economic Community, for example, in 1973, he wasn't Taoiseach then, but I think without him, that might not have happened. And I think that's been incredibly consequential for Ireland and also with relationship with the UK. So I think he would certainly be one of the, shall we say, older Taoiseach that I would point out. I think of the current crop, I mean, Bertie Ahern, who in this country we think of as a sort of very great man, but most people in Britain don't know the circumstances of his departure from office. And in Ireland, I think he's seen as very, very different how we see him in the UK. I mean, we would think of his role in the Good Friday Agreement as absolutely crucial, and therefore everything else sort of is subsidiary to that. But I think given the whole sort of economic development of Ireland during his period, I think he's probably the most consequential Taoiseach of modern times.
Now, you've also looked at American presidents, a very different kind of role. How does the US presidency or the US president vary from other ruling chief executives, as it were?
Well, everyone thinks that a US president is a quasi-dictator, and with the current incumbent, I suppose you could be forgiven for thinking that. And indeed, in the Ford for the Dictators book, Professor Ian Robinson from Trinity College Dublin, he wrote a piece on the psychology of dictators and explained how, although Donald Trump is not a dictator, he certainly has a lot of the personal traits of a dictator. I mean, the Constitution of the United States, it was written very carefully, and all the different amendments that have followed have been absolutely crucial in effectively balancing the different arms of government, whether it's the executive, the legislature, or indeed the head of state. And that hasn't really changed much over the years. I mean, Donald Trump is pushing at the boundaries of a lot of those things, but in some ways, he is still restricted by some of the powers that were given to the president in the American Constitution of 1776.
I mean, they refer to it as the bully pulpit. What do you interpret that phrase? How do you interpret that phrase, bully pulpit, in terms of the influence at the very least, whatever about the power, but the influence of the American presidency?
Well, to me, that term means that the president is there to reflect the mood of the nation, to represent the nation. And some of the best American presidents have used that to their own great advantage. Ronald Reagan, I think, would be one. Abraham Lincoln, another. Theodore Roosevelt, another. People who sort of embody the whole sense of what being an American is. I mean, it's a bit different for a Taoiseach or prime minister because they're not the head of state. So they're not there to necessarily have the same sort of emblematic symbols that an American president does. And I think that the American presidents that have failed have generally been those ones who haven't really been able to rise to the occasion. I mean, Jimmy Carter, who I think after he left the office, his reputation was much better than when he was actually acting as president. he just didn't have this sense of optimism that Reagan exemplified. I remember that morning in America phrase that Reagan used, whereas Jimmy Carter was associated with economic malaise. I think if you go back in history, even going back to the 19th century, those presidents that exuded optimism were able to articulate the sense of American destiny. They were the ones that actually succeeded.
We've had 250 years of American independence, not quite as many years of American presidents. But when you look at all of them, who, in your opinion, was the greatest American president?
Lincoln, without a shadow of a doubt. I think any historian would come to that conclusion. American academics often draw up lists of sort of, well, the best and the worst. And the best always include Lincoln, both of the Roosevelts. I mean, Kennedy scrapes in sometimes, but I always think with Kennedy that he only scrapes into these lists because he was assassinated rather than for what he actually achieved. And he was only president for 3 years. And when you look at his achievements, I mean, there weren't that many. The Vietnam War effectively started under his presidency. He didn't do much on civil rights. It was Lyndon Johnson that did that. So there's always a good debate over who's the best and who's the worst.
Okay, well then, that's my follow-up question. Who is the worst? Who are the candidates, at least, for worst president?
Well, Richard Nixon is one that a more recent one that often comes to mind in this. I have to say, I'm fascinated by Nixon. I think without Watergate, and I know you can't take it out of the equation, but if you do take it out of the equation, I think he would have been in the top 10 presidents, both for his domestic policy and indeed his foreign policy. He was the creator of détente. He opened up relations with China, started to bring the Vietnam War to an end. So I think he had a lot of achievements, but you ask most Americans and they would put him way down the bottom of the list. You go back in time, and I think Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, might be on that list too. But then there were quite a few that only lasted one term in the 19th century. Rutherford Hayes, James Polk, ones that, frankly, most people have never heard of nowadays.
This would be the mid-19th century nobodies, basically.
Yeah, and there were quite a few of them, to be
Franklin
honest.
Franklin Pierce, a name to conjure with.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you do books like this, I mean, even I, as an ultimate political geek, I mean, there were some presidents I had literally never heard of. There were a few prime ministers I'd never heard of. Editing books like this, you really do learn a lot about your own country's history and that of other countries. And the great thing is, if you're doing a book of essays of sort of 47 American presidents or 55 British prime ministers, you don't want to read biographies of all of them. So you do sort of 10, 15 pages on each. And the idea is that then if somebody's particularly captivated by one of them, they then go and read a proper biography of them.
You've done prime ministers, presidents, dictators, monarchs, Taoiseach. I believe somewhere on the horizon is generals. Are you a military historian?
I'm not a military historian at all, which has made me rather apprehensive of doing this book, but it's been an absolutely fascinating experience. It's coming out on the 5th of June, and it's 69 generals from history going back to the days of ancient Rome. I mean, obviously, there's more British and American generals in there than any others. And a lot of the ancient ones I literally knew nothing about, but I know a lot of people that do know a lot about them. So, and that's the joy of these books, putting the jigsaw together, recruiting the author to write about a particular subject.
What about Taoiseach, who don't seem to want to write about themselves? I mean, it seems to be obligatory for American presidents, UK prime ministers, we have to write a memoir. That's what we settle down to, and we spend the first 2 years after we get booted out or we retire or whatever, and we write our memoir. Not so popular amongst Irish Taoiseach for some reason. Do you think there's any particular reason for that?
Well, I don't know is the honest answer. It does seem really odd because, as you say, it's almost a rite of passage. Certainly in this country, every prime minister writes a book. And I think they should, just for historical purposes. You want to know, well, they were there. They were sat at the table. They were at the centre of the decision-making process. I want to know. Doesn't everyone want to know what Keir Starmer really thinks about Donald Trump? Well, we're only going to know that when he writes his memoirs. And I mean, I think, well, obviously Leo Varadkar has written one recently, but I think is it the third or the fourth to do so? Which is very, very odd. I mean, Sean Lamass, there's a new sort of autobiography of his that's just come out based on some recordings that
that's
he
Ronan,
did.
Ronan McGreevy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I haven't read that yet, but I'm going to. I think that should be quite fascinating. But it is a shame that a lot of them haven't. I mean, the ones that are still alive now, I mean, I would like to read Enda Kenny's memoirs.
You actually rate Enda Kenny, don't you? Very, very highly.
I do. I think he took over at a very, very difficult time. And I think he really stabilised Ireland in the financial sense, in the economic sense. I think also sort of some of the social legislation that was passed when he was Taoiseach is obviously very, very important. So I think he's another one, a bit like John Major in this country. I think they're going to be seen by historians as much more significant than maybe contemporary commentators would say.
I could talk to you all day, but we'll have to leave it there. Ian Dale, most recent book, The Taoiseach, A Century of Political Leadership, published by Swift Press. We look forward to the Generals coming out in June. And by the way, Ian will be appearing at the West Cork History Festival in August. Ian Dale, many thanks indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Gar Duffy and Niall McMonagall on sound, and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.